You are listening to The Big Interview, first broadcast on the 8th of November 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello, I'm Robert Bound, and this is The Big Interview, our one-on-one programme in which people with extraordinary lives, powerful careers, and maybe even tall tales sit down to tell us what really happened, how they got here, and what makes them tick. Today, I'm talking to Ian McKellen, the actor steeped in decades of Shakespearean history, tragedy, and comedy, but who's best known, can we say loved here, for playing Gandalf in Peter Jackson's record-breaking Lord of the Rings and Hobbit trilogies and Magneto in X-Men, Marvel's monstrous Hollywood franchise. McKellen's famous for the sort of range that can encompass a blood-curdling fascist reimagining of Richard III on film, a sad, loopy Estragon in Waiting for Godot on stage, and a bitchy half of an aging gay couple in a TV sitcom, and most recently, a nonagenarian Sherlock Holmes and a nasty but vulnerable puppet master of a dresser on BBC TV. McKellen is also lauded for principle. In 1988, he came out in support of the debate surrounding the repealing of Section 28 in the UK, a law which had hitherto banned the intentional promotion of homosexuality. Ian McKellen stands for a lot more than just skill or stardom. Ian McKellen was born in Burnley in Lancashire in 1939 and attended St Catherine's College, Cambridge, where he fell headlong in love with acting as part of the Marlowe Society. Touring repertory theatre followed, then the West End, Broadway, TV, film, although he's perhaps unlikely to grade them in any sort of order. We could spend the day in his house here on the Thames, bumping into his awards, of course. Ian McKellen, thank you very much for having me.
No, you couldn't. Where are these awards?
I wrote this before I came.
Ah, can you see any awards?
I can't see any awards. I can see some bits and bobs I recognise. It's always nice.
Yes. I've got Gandalf's hat down in the basement. In fact, you could tell your listeners I'm wearing it right now.
This is the magic of radio. I see also Magneto's hat in the corner of the room.
Oh, that's right. You see it? It is.
That's for
young people who come round and they want to try it on.
Do these come out on high days and holidays? Are these artifacts?
No, that's permanent.
There.
If you want to see Gandalf's staff, you have to go to the pub, which I co-own, called The Grapes in Limehouse. And there it is behind the bar.
Oh, right. It's the equivalent of the yard of ale. Or the shotgun. I wanted to talk to you about some of the work of acting, actually, which people, as you say, people want to kind of hear, you know, when the set fell down or when, you know, when the staff broke in half or when something happened like this. But is that one of the things that people underestimate, the actual work of it? The script pops on the front doormat and there is a lot of stuff involved before you ever set foot in an agent's office, let alone on the stage or on the set of a film.
Well, yes, acting is a job, isn't it? If you're doing a play, it's likely that you'll be involved in the planning of it, because who's going to play the leading parts in a play will be crucial to probably whether it happens or it doesn't. So I rather enjoy that, because I like to know what the director is thinking, how it might be, what the design of the play might look like, where we might be performing it, how long a rehearsal we might get. And even sometimes a little bit to do with the casting of the rest of the actors. So I feel very involved. But a film, the actors are the last thing to be engaged, I suppose, unless you're Tom Hanks or Tom Cruise, in which case everything's organised around you. But the sort of parts I play, everything's all rather set up. And then you feel very much like a hired help, and getting involved can be rather tricky, because it's all rather quick, and you arrive on the first day not to rehearse. You'll have had your costume designed and your makeup if necessary, but on the first day you're just expected to act with no real preparation, so unless you've done it yourself. So you do it yourself, of course. You learn the lines and you puzzle over how they fit in, and you probably won't start filming at the beginning of the film, but maybe midway through, depending on which location or studio you're visiting. But it is work, whether it's hard work, depends how you look at it. Many people think that the last thing they could imagine themselves doing is standing up in public and risking making a fool of themselves or talking in front of a large live audience, again, would be horrific to most people. That is the easy side of acting to me. The difficult side is believing myself to be the character, and that can take energy and imagination and a lot of chat with the director, of course, and maybe the writer and the other actors. There's a lot more time involved in making a film or a play than you would imagine. But whether it's hard work, you know, you have to get up early if you're filming. and you have to stay up late if you're acting in the theatre. So, but again, that doesn't seem like work to me. And if I weren't a professional actor, I'd probably be a hardworking amateur actor. So it's just something I like to do and want to do.
And you talked about having to be a certain type of Tom, a Hanks or a Cruise, in order to have the world revolving around you and films made for you. You've been in a position with The Lord of the Rings and X-Men as well, I guess, where those films have turned into fantastic, very handsome juggernauts, and you've been the best known hat and staff in town. Does that change the way that those productions work and the way that your involvement in them works when there is suddenly expectation and a great deal of it when so many people are working on that set?
The joy of those series of films was the joy that I've just been talking about in a company of actors in the theatre. It was the same group. Not just the actors, because between Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, there was a wholesale change of cast. But the director was the same, the designers was the same, the makeup person put on my makeup was the same, my dresser was the same. It felt like being at home and very comfortable indeed. Well, when you're making a film, or indeed rehearsing a play, it does cross your mind, is anyone going to see this? Is anyone going to want to see it? Well, I hope they'll want to, because if I'm in it, you can be guaranteed it's worth doing. I mean, I don't do any job unless it's the sort of product that I would enjoy coming to see as an audience. But that said, the end result may not be good enough. The critics may not like it. The audience might stay away for any number of reasons that you can't quite work out. But the expectation of people coming to see the second Lord of the Rings films and the second X-Men were people who wanted us to make the films. They approved of what we'd done thus far and they wanted more of it. Well, that's a very, very unusual situation to be in. And it makes it much easier, much more relaxed. You know you're doing something that's already approved of in advance, and that's not usually the case. So going back constantly to Middle Earth was it almost at times felt like a duty, you know. There were millions of people throughout the world, people of all ages, who wanted you to be doing the job. So for an actor like me, who started in the theatre and still loves the theatre, primarily because there's an audience there live whilst you're telling the story, to know in a film where you normally don't meet an audience, and you can tell by the way that film actors arrive on stage at the Oscars rather surprised to find there's a live audience there and terrified as they read the prompter and stumbling over their words and not quite able to put one foot in front of another, that they don't know about live audiences, but I do. And the only reason you do any job in our business is to entertain the audience, to please them. So the certainty there was an audience for those big films was made the job easier, and you knew it had a purpose.
Yeah. I wonder if there's whether you make any distinction between playing Estragon on stage and playing Gandalf on a film set, whether you make any distinction in your head between the characters. Obviously, the characters are very different, but the value of those characters, there's such a value to those characters, one in high culture, one in pop culture.
Oh,
whether
I see.
You treat those imposters just the same.
Well, my taste in storytelling is Catholic. You know, I like highbrow stuff and I like whatever is not highbrow. I like musicals, I like pantomime, I like classic plays, I love new plays, always interesting. On telly, I enjoy soap operas. And if people are surprised that this Shakespearean actor turns up on Coronation Street, or if viewers of Coronation Street are surprised to discover that Ian McKellen's played Macbeth and Coriolanus and King Lear, it doesn't surprise me. And there's no distinction to me between all that variety of work, because what connects them all is that I won't be doing it unless the script's good. So if it's good of its type, then I'm a candidate, really. In fact, one added spur for me of choosing a part is that it's something I'm not entirely certain I'm going to be able to carry off, bring off.
Then you know you've got a little frisson of danger, a little butterflies presumably help the process.
Because, not that I particularly like the danger, it can be nerve-wracking, really. But the satisfaction of when you land on it and the director says, cut, we've got that. Ooh, the relief that everything's worked is enormous, but very enjoyable. And the same in the theatre. I mean, there's always a point, my friends get bored with me, toward the end of a rehearsal of any play, old, new, and I'm absolutely convinced that I'm not going to be able to do it well enough. But that's just my temperament, but it does spur me on to try harder.
So that the rest of the cast roll their eyes and folds their arms and goes, classic McCallum.
Well, no. But on the whole, actors are very nice to each other. But if you're working with Judi Dench, let's say, she'll be all at sea to begin with, partly because she doesn't read the script. Her husband, her late husband, used to read scripts for her. I don't know who does it now. And she arrives in a rather bewildered state of affairs, sometimes saying, I thought you told me this was a good part, to the director. And then there's a sort of gestation period for her. Well, you don't really notice because you're busy trying to get in touch with your own character. And suddenly, Judy's not there anymore and the character is. She lands on it. I don't suppose she could tell you herself how she does it, but she does, always. Others will plod their way through. Others, like me, will be a bit erratic and land on something that's good and a lot that isn't. And everyone has different ways of doing it. And the job of the director really is to keep these horses who are all going at different speeds going in the same direction.
And how likely are cast members to see you being a little ragged, being a horse that sort of doesn't want to be saddled?
Well, all the time, and it can't be very easy. I wish I had a method. I wish I could join a group that had the same method and we could all do it together. I was once worked with a director who accomplished that, Mike Alfreds. He had a method of directing his plays, productions, that brought everyone together. Too long to explain now, but it involved a long rehearsal period in which you examine the characters and other people's characters until you knew so much about them that playing them became almost effortless. And there was no concentration on where you should move or how you should say a line. It was just information, information, information. And when that works well, you get to the state where nothing is planned. You walk through the door on cue, you hear the line before yours and you start, and then you move where you want on the stage. And others respond to that and you respond to them. And in the moment, you are creating a performance which no other audience will ever see, which is only possible because everybody's been working together very intimately. Usually productions are not of that sort. Usually it's a lot of people doing different sorts of things and being pulled together probably at the last minute to put on a show where it looks as if it's all inevitable.
Lots of women used to send you fan mail and, you know, scratch.
Are you talking about me? Or
yeah, I'm talking about you. Ian McKellen.
Well, I didn't get fan mail when I was in my heartthrob years. I had my fan mail in my dotage. And very satisfactory to me that. When I was growing up, there was a phrase to be used all the time, really. Prime of life. You and your prime. Something to look forward to when you were a kid. You didn't expect money when you were a kid. You didn't expect success. You were working towards that. And in your middle years, if you had a family and you'd settled down, you knew how to do your job better than you did before, you were perhaps earning a bit more money, you were in your prime. Well, my prime arrived when I was about 60. And thank goodness, because I've to become famous when you're young as an actor, it could be extremely dangerous because you become famous for the performance that everybody likes. And then what do they want? They want more of it. And unless you're a Fassbender or Martin Freeman, who, you know, wonderful actors who can do different things, you can get stuck. It's called being a star, isn't it? I mean, nobody wants a star to be different. They want them to be the same all the time. Well, that's anathema to me. I've always wanted to be different. I look different, sound different, think differently, walk differently. And I still want that. But I happened to have been given, I still don't know how it happened, two iconic characters who allowed me to become so established in film that I was allowed to play other parts, like Gods and Monsters and Apt Pupil and Sherlock Holmes. So it's all worked out very well for me, really.
We talked about your heartthrob years, and you reckon that they were in
your 60s. I could hardly get that word out. My tongue was so firmly in my cheek. But
And I've read elsewhere that you used to get nice fan mail from people, from women and all the rest of it. Hmm. And you came out in 1988. And we mentioned that in the introduction surrounding the repealing of Section 28.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether, I mean, that was obviously a subject that you felt strongly about and felt that it wasn't as if you kept your sexuality a secret, but why you chose that moment to make it public, whether you felt that you had a weight at that point to make a difference. Or your name held a weight to make a difference.
Oh, I see. Oh, no. I don't think that's a good motive for coming out and being honest. And the reason to come out, if you're gay, is to take charge of your life and demand, really, the same respect that for you, for what you are, as you would accord other people and as they would accord other people. So there's nothing odd about being gay. It's not. There is something odd about being secret about being gay, because then you're leading half a life. And my motive to come out was, I think, selfish, you know, in that good sense. A dear friend had talked to me about it and recommended it. But Armistead Maupin, this was, the author of Tales of the City in San Francisco when I was on tour there. But he said to me, look, the more people in public eye come out, the easier it will be for people who are not in the public eye to come out. And it was a time when most gay people in the world were closeted, and it's an American expression, best translated into English, gay people who live in a cupboard. It's a very good, it's what it feels like. Mm. Yeah, in the cupboard, it's a bit dark in there, it's a bit dusty, there's a few skeletons there. You want to open the door and not just open it and peep out, but fling it off its hinges and walk out and join the rest of humanity. Well, when you do that, and it won't be done necessarily, no, it won't ever be done just like that. You can't run up a flag in the front garden and say Ian McKellen's gay and that's that. No, it's every person you meet. You don't mind them knowing you're gay. It might come up in the conversation, it might not. But it's something that you don't hide. That can take a long time. It did for me, 49 years. Some people these days accomplish it when they're 13 or something. Wonderful.
I wonder whether the environment of the theatre and film is a very supportive environment in yes. order to do that.
Well, you're quite right. Nobody in the theatre, even long, long ago when I started acting, really gives a damn about anyone's private life. They could be fascinated by it, but they're not judgmental. You can't be, because you're working together as a group very intimately. You're in rehearsal, I mean, discovering things about yourself, about your emotions and so on, and about your behaviour. You're experimenting and trying things out and risking and falling flat on your face and being rather daring. You can only do that in the company of people who honour you for your work. And that's the principal way in which people are judged in the theatre. Are they any good at the job? Are they trying? Do they want to get better? Not who are they sleeping with or how much money they're earning or where they come from. Or, no, they don't even have to be very nice. Usually are, but they don't have to be. I mean, you're doing a job together, and you can only do the job if you're doing it with people who you respect and preferably like. That's why actors call each other darling, you know. It's not because we can't remember each other's names. It's because we are darlings. You can't do it if you're not, really. So to be gay in that atmosphere is easy. And almost every area of my life I was out. I'd lived with a series of partners and went out with them. On all occasions, had gay friends, straight friends. I never hid it from anyone I was working with at all. But there were two areas of my life where I wasn't out of the closet, and that was with close members of my blood family. And a bit of coming out, which most people don't have to bother about, and that's talking publicly about it and to the media. Well, the media never asked. They thought it was the worst thing they could possibly say about anybody, that they were gay, so they never asked the question. Simon Callow, who was out before I was, a younger actor, could never get the media interested. He would keep saying he was gay in interviews. No, it was never printed.
They just shrug.
The lawyers, you know, the paper said, don't put that in, he'll sue you. As you know, Liberace very successfully sued the Daily Mirror because they suggested he was gay. Simon had to write a book to come out. So I came out when the Thatcher government was passing a law, Section 28, which inhibited local authorities from what was called promoting homosexuality. It meant that in schools you couldn't talk sensibly about the subject. And I took personal offence at that. And it was very easy after my conversations with Armistead Maupin to then declare myself and come out. And you might think that was it. But you can be in a cab, I can be in a cab, and the cabbie will say, why are you in? I'm fine. You know. I've always wondered, have you got any grandchildren? And you're going home, it's the end of a long day, and you think, am I going to start telling this man that I don't have grandchildren because at an age when I might have been having children, I couldn't get married, and anyway, I'm gay. And sometimes I just say, no, and realise that in regard to that cabbie, I'm still in the closet. So I gather my energies together and say, no, you can see, as a matter of fact, I don't have grandchildren because I'm gay. And the cabbie was these days likely to say, yeah, so am I. And then you have a laugh and you realise the world's got a bit better over the last few years. But it was a wonderful thing for me to come out in those circumstances because I was middle-aged, I was successful as an actor, my self-confidence suddenly grew, the weight that I hadn't realised was on my shoulders fell away, the lines of communication between my guts and my heart and my ability to express both, very useful for an actor, were cleared. I became a better actor and became a better family member. I became a better friend. I became a better person all round. And I could talk about it and wanted to on behalf of other people who weren't as lucky as I was. And I've gone on doing that. So I found the best part I've ever played, really, which is being an openly gay man.
And do you still think it's a crap question for people to ask you? Because it might have been in the day when people would have not told the truth about it. I hope I asked that question for the reason that it's something that can help other people who are aspiring in any job in the world or well, just aspiring to be themselves.
You'll find what connects gay people who are not honest about their sexuality is that they're worried about what other people will think. It's as simple as that. So the closeted politician says, if I come out, I won't get re-elected. The first politician to come out in this country was Chris Smith, and his majority went up at the next election. Shock, horror, surprise. Well, people like an honest politician, don't they? And there was one patently in front of them. Teachers worry about what will their kids think? Will they lose their ability to control the classroom? I went to a school the other day and in front of the entire school said it was a pity that there were no openly gay members of staff. And they were frightened of what the reaction might be from their students. And a young man, so young, I thought he was in the sixth form, put his hand up and said, well, I'm a member of staff and I'm gay. He came out in front of the entire school who cheered him. He didn't have anything to be frightened of, as it turned out. And I came out, and if I'd been worried that no one would take me seriously as an actor, if they didn't like the fact I was gay, well, my film career took off. So I had nothing to be frightened of. So, but everyone's always worried. I remember when I came out, I came out to my stepmother. She was fine about it. She said, you're not going to tell your sister, are you? Yes, I said. I told my sister Jean. She says, oh, that's lovely. I've always wanted to talk to you about it. Don't tell Aunt Dorothy, will you? I tell Aunt Dorothy. And finally I got down to my nephew, Stephen in Newcastle, called him up. And he said, oh, I said, that's fine, Uncle, but I'm just glad you didn't tell me a couple of years ago when I was still at school, because I didn't know what the boys at school would have thought. Everyone's always worried about somebody else. And honesty is the best policy. And in this part of the world, there is absolutely no reason not to come out, I think. But I don't live in an extreme situation where the family will definitely disapprove, and cruelly so, like throw you out of the house. And the Albert Kennedy Trust, of which I'm a patron, I think dealt with 8,000 cases of young people who were homeless because their families didn't approve of them being gay. So there are. But is that a reason why someone should not be honest? Well, the world has got to change. And having changed the laws, having got rid of Section 28, having an equal age of consent, gays being able to serve in the military, every commercial company you can think of with an LGBT group within it, advising the company on how to deal with gay members of staff. Even so, it can be very, very hard. And that's why talking about it can have some positive impact. And then thinking beyond this country, where people are publicly hanged for being gay or stoned to death. You see it on the internet. Stoned to death for making love. What sort of a world is this? Well, it's barbarous and medieval, really. Even in this country, we don't have equality yet.
So you going to a school and doing a shout-out and some one member of staff coming out right there and then in front of his whole school, it makes a massive difference. It can make a massive difference.
It can, but it doesn't depend on me, and it's wonderfully ironic that that law, Section 28, which forbade a school to speak positively about gay, has now been utterly reversed, and the law of the land is that you may not discriminate on grounds of sexuality in a school. And it is their duty to make sure that doesn't happen. How do you do that? Well, kids have to talk about sexuality and understand that it's not grounds for discrimination. And if discrimination takes place, it has to be tackled head-on, which means every school I go into has quite a lot of young people who are openly gay. And often the head teacher is openly gay. There are governors who are openly gay. There are openly gay people who are sending their children, straight kids, to that school. There are trans children dealing with that particular gender issues. And the most heartening thing of all the other day was that three sixth form girls, one of them said in a little meeting I had, well, she said, I identify as bisexual. Still a shock to me when a young person is so clear about themselves. And she said, but when I'm with a boy, of course I'm straight, aren't I? And then when I'm with a girl, I suppose, well, I'm lesbian. But what is all this? She said, I don't like these labels. And the other two girls said, absolutely, we don't want to be labelled. And I thought, yes, of course, that's the future. We embrace and celebrate and accept that it's very difficult to define and that everyone's different, and thank goodness it's... So that, I hope, I think, is the future. And yeah. I was taught that not because I understood it, but because 3 17-year-olds taught me.
Ian McKellen, thank you very much for your time today.
No, a pleasure.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Robert Bound, in conversation with Ian McKellen. Next week, we'll head to Munich to talk graphic design with Mirko Borsch. The Big Interview is produced by Bill Luthi, researched by Gaia Lutz, and edited by Nina Norek. Don't forget to subscribe to this and any of our other programmes on Monocle 24. They can be found on iTunes, SoundCloud, or, of course, monocle.com. Until next time, all that's left to say is goodbye, and thank you very much for tuning in.